All right, I'm Bruce and I'm an alcoholic. Good morning, all the hardy ones that were able to get through the road,
I think one of the things about telling your story that's good for me is that it reminds me of how much my story has changed, one of the books I really like, is A New Pair of Glasses. And, I would describe it more like my prescription is changing all the time, because the way I see not only today, but the way I see my past, is pretty different than it was the last time I told my story. And I think that's I don't see that as a bad thing. I'm kind of excited about the fact that I really would like to believe, at least, that I'm going to see something new today that I haven't seen before, and that's the cool thing about A New Pair of Glasses. The other thing that I realize today that I, as you hear my story, you'll hear a lot of me avoiding things. And, even though I'm not sure that I live this way as much as I would like to, I believe one of the beautiful things about AA for me is the way we embrace wounds, the truth for me is that wounds unite us. And it's not so much all the accolades or this, that, and the other thing. It's the wounds. It's the common suffering. It's the common, that's a common bond. And as we, a lot of what I think makes a story useful is if it comes from a place of vulnerability, a place where you're, I think there's a relationship between vulnerability and intimacy. If you're, those of you guys who are mothers know that, in the vulnerability of a newborn, there is this intimacy that develops because they can't take care of themselves, this week has been, I feel kind of fragile and vulnerable today because my parents are getting old. My dad's 85 and has reached a point where he's unable to do a lot of things that he was able to do even a year ago. And so this week we moved them kind of into a much smaller place. And maybe a third of what they had we were able to move. And there's two thirds that we had to let go of. And there's a lot of memories that you have, and it kind of brings back all this stuff, and so it's probably a good thing for me to tell my story today. If I were to try to put it in a very objective way, I had a pretty amazing childhood. I had these really cool parents that were supportive and wanted the best for me. I was the oldest of four boys. I don't have this alcoholism in my family, this drug addiction in my family, all kinds of, abuse in my family. I don't have any of that. But I have my wounds, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you that my wounds, I've heard a lot of stories, and man, there's some cool, there's some pretty amazing wounds that people have endured and overcome. And I'm not going to tell you that I think any of my wounds merit any special recognition, okay? They're pretty minor stuff, But one of the things about wounds isn't so much what they are, it's what you do with them, my youngest son actually is here, and he probably won't like me telling this story, but he had an infection in his foot, and he didn't do anything about it, And that infection, man, got really, really bad to the point that we had to go to a podiatrist, and, you know, and all of a sudden, as you dealt with that wound, it just kind of exploded, you know. And so even very small things, you know, if we don't deal with them, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And if you just ignore them, you know, as long as I've ignored a lot of mine, you know, they become these huge problems, you know. And in a physical way, you ignore a wound long enough and it can develop into staph and it can kill you, you know, even something minor. So, you know, I think what my life, my early life was about was coming up with my own way of dealing with my wounds and not talking about it. And, you know, my wounds were, again, I think simple, normal things that anybody experiences. So, you know, my perception at least today is that, you know, I was kind of a mommy's boy, you know. And when I was young, I really liked hanging out with my mom, you know. And it was like, you know, this idea of going to school was bullshit, you know. Why do I want to, you know, why would I want to leave mom? It's pretty cool staying here with mom, okay. So why do I have to go to school? And why do I have to ride a bus and, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, so, you know, I don't think anybody told me, Bruce, this is the way to process this. This was just the way I processed it, was that, you know, if I wanted to grow up, I needed to figure out how to shut off feelings, you know, because it hurt and I didn't want to hurt. And so, okay, so how do I shut off the way I feel? And, you know, that became a core competence. You know, I think I'm pretty good at shutting off how I feel. I spent a lot of years having no idea how I felt. And so, you know, that, you know, and then there were the things that I did that in my mind were wounds. You know, I remember, again, in kindergarten, you know, I couldn't make it all the way, you know, from school to home without, you know, on the bus without going to the bathroom, you know, and that, you know, was this incredible wound, you know, in my life, that it was like there was something wrong with me, you know, there is something wrong with this kid because other kids didn't do that, and you know, and so I had this belief, you know, this was my truth, that these shortcomings that I had, these things that I couldn't do well, were, you know, made me, you know, less than. And I really kind of began to have this kind of way of looking at my life as thinking that the truth was that I was less than, and the truth was that I was, you know, incapable, and the truth was that I was, you know, not worthy. And, you know, the game I played was to convince you and others that I was. And that somehow, if I convinced you that I was worthy, then maybe you could convince me, you know. And that's kind of the way I think I lived, you know, lived a lot of my life, you know. And so I was, the way I tried to feel better about myself as a young kid was achievement. You know, I wanted to do something to prove that I was okay. You know, so I wanted to do well in school. I wanted to be able to do some things that would show you that, you know, look, you know, I'm okay. And so life, you know, life gets pretty, even for a young kid, life gets pretty pressure filled when everything is about a performance and some kind of, you know, way of affirming that you ought to be breathing. You know, again, these little memories that I have of growing up, it's not like, I mean, I'm sure there's like tons of all these really, you know, uplifting, warm things, but a lot of what I remember are these darker things, you know. I got into this pattern when I was in third grade of the first day of school, getting sick the first day of school, and that lasted from third grade through seventh grade. And so I would spend the summer kind of terrified that, oh, I'm going to go through and, you know, get sick the first day of school. And then all of a sudden, I am going to be kind of this kid that's, you know, alone and isolated and that kind of thing. So again, this is all normal, you know, kind of stuff in some form or fashion. But what the message was for me was I wasn't okay, number one. Number two, I was alone, man. And there wasn't anybody that I felt like. And see, I got the message that my job was to do it all myself. And if I needed to ask for help, something was wrong. I wasn't, you know, the strong person that I was supposed to be. So there was a lot of those kind of things. And I would take, you know, a very minor disappointment and it would be huge. You know, I was one of the warm memories I have of being young was my dad being a t-ball coach, you know, and me playing t-ball, and I love t-ball. And I thought, you know, I was okay at t-ball. And then I had my, you know, and then I went up to the next level, and then my younger brother, you know, became the next in line to play t-ball. And man, he was really good. And he was a lot better than I was. And he got advanced to the next league, you know, at the same time I was there, and he was doing a lot better in that next league than I was doing. And so, you know, again, that the psychologically I was giving myself this message that there was something wrong with me. And there was all this fear and anxiousness, you know, about my life. The way I kind of dealt with it, like I said, was to become as achievement oriented as I could. And it was all about, I felt most comfortable with individual achievement, you know, and I didn't really want to put myself in a place I was going to fail. Because if I'm going to fail, man, that's pretty devastating. So let me make sure I can succeed, and let me stack the deck as best I can so that I can succeed. And, you know, part of success for me was then shutting off the need for other people. You know, I can remember one of my mantras as a kid was just leave me alone. You know, I wanted to be left alone. You know, I didn't want to have to deal with other people. And I wanted to be left alone. So, you know, what I think that wasn't all bad because I became, you know, I was willing to be different. You know, I didn't really fit in a lot of ways, and I was willing to be different. You know, I can remember, you know, as a freshman in high school, you know, I would carry this briefcase, you know, with me, and I would have all these books in it. And, you know, and I was like, you know, you guys don't like it, tough, you know. And I didn't feel, you know, at that, you know, I was trying to, you know, to be somebody, to have some kind of an identity. And, you know, so that's kind of where I was. And I was not happy. I was full of fear. I didn't have any social skills, and I really hadn't learned the normal coping skills of, you know, of just how to deal with failure, how to deal with my own shortcomings and not kind of self-destruct or internalize it all. So there's a lot of basic kind of emotional coping stuff that I never really did very well. And then when I was 15, you know, I discovered, you know, alcohol. And man, this was like, what a great discovery, you know. So, you know, the first time I drank, it was, I really didn't like the taste and it really wasn't good. But the second time, my parents had gone out of town, and I invited a bunch of people over, and I got, you know, I had what I thought was a normal experience, which is blacking out, you know. And, you know, the next morning, you know, I woke up hungover, feeling terrible, and then I couldn't wait to do it again. You know, I was anxious to do it again because what, you know, getting completely blown away for me gave me this sense of being more normal and being more connected. And when I was wasted, I could feel, you know, kind of a human connection that I didn't feel when I wasn't. And so I became kind of this Jekyll and Hyde character who was driven and functional, you know, during the day and during most days, and then, you know, absolutely focused on, you know, getting blown away when I drank, you know, and that was the way I lived, you know. And I also became very good at lying, you know. It was another core competence. And the lies, you know, as I think back on them, it's almost like, you know, it was not just about lying to you, it was about lying to myself. And I became really good at having these compartments in my life. Okay, this is a part of my life that I can share with you. This is a part of my life I'm not going to share with you. And, you know, it felt very normal to me because all these wounds that I had experienced as a kid, some of these things I'm telling you today, I haven't ever told anybody, I don't think, you know. So they're just things that, you know, I never had, I just, you know, they were secrets, you know, and, you know, we hear in the room, secrets will keep you sick, right? So I had no way to deal with this stuff. I just put it all kind of in this closet of stuff. And you know, that's really the way I dealt with it. And then, you know, in college, you know, it became easy for me to arrange my schedule so that I had more time for drinking and drugging, you know. So I would always keep my Fridays, you know, open so I could get, you know, completely blown away Thursday night, Friday night, and Saturday night. And that was kind of this normal routine I had. And I thought that was pretty normal, you know. It was, you know, letting off steam, you know. I needed this to let off steam. And so that was kind of the way that my life began. And I really, I would say at that point in my life was, I'm not sure how I would describe it, you know, in terms of alcoholism, but I was pretty satisfied with my life. This was not a problem. This was, you know, I thought a very good way for me to live my life. I was accomplishing meaningful things in my mind, and I was having a good time. So what's wrong with that, you know? And if I have to lie and I have to cheat and I have to, you know, do whatever to accomplish things the way that I want to, so what, you know? So I became much more focused on I should be able to do whatever I need to do to accomplish what I want. And there doesn't need to be a whole lot of principle in anything I do. You know, spiritually, you know, I had grown up, you know, with the church, and there was a time, you know, this, you know, the whole Southern Baptist thing, you know, with this kind of judgmental God. And I probably at about the same time I started drinking, you know, let go of any concept of God, you know, and I felt a lot of anger toward God because it felt to me like, you know, I had been dealt some cards that I didn't want to be dealt. Like one of the big things that, you know, was a struggle for me was my size. You know, I was listed in the junior varsity basketball roster. As a junior, I played, you know, JV basketball, and I was listed at 5'4", 100 pounds, and that was an overstatement, you know. There was no way I was that. So I was really little for my age. You know, going into the shower was painful because it's like, you know, where's your pubic hairs, you know, you know. And, I mean, it sucked, you know. And so, you know, again, I developed this really tough persona, you know, in high school to try to survive. You know, my nickname in high school was Mugger, and it's because I was this really little guy. But I didn't, you know, you give me any crap, and I'm going to fight you, you know, and that's the way that I, you know, kind of that was those were the coping skills that I had developed up to this point. So so spiritually, I was angry at God because, you know, one of the things I had prayed for was to be 6'3 and 180, you know, and to be, you know, be able to get a basketball scholarship and to, you know, and I had done, I thought, you know, my part, you know, so God, you're supposed to do your part, you know, and so I had this conditional relationship with God that it was about, you know, dude, you know, this is my plan, so I'll do what you want me to do, but you got to do what, you know, I want you to do. And so when I saw God not doing that, it was like, this is bullshit. I don't need this. You know, it's this is a waste of time. So, you know, I kind of let go of any kind of a spiritual connection. And, you know, I began to worship. The things I worshiped were self-knowledge. You know, if I had a problem, then I ought to be able to fix it. And I worshiped, you know, drugs and alcohol. They were solutions for me that, you know, I wanted to protect, and I wanted to find a way to be able to continue to use. So, you know, the point of all that really wasn't just to tell you that. The point of all that was to tell you that I had some, you know, less than normal ways of dealing with my life, but long before I discovered drugs and alcohol. And those less than normal ways of dealing with problems never began to really change, you know, while I was using, because I could kind of survive in this bizarre way that I had. So somehow, you know, I got through college. I actually did okay in college, got a decent job. I lived in Ohio. We grew up in Ohio. You know, the one thing that when I took this job, I said, hey, you know, I'd rather not go to New York because, you know, New York at that time, this was in the 70s, this was 77. New York was pretty rough. And I was concerned about living in New York. So, of course, that's where they transferred me, was to New York. I think my alcoholism and my drug addiction really started to advance, because I really became dependent upon drugs and alcohol to function. I can remember, you know, there's this, you know, you're using kind of every day just to try to kind of keep this balance. And, you know, sometimes you go over the edge. You know, I can remember being at a business dinner and, you know, somebody said, you know, have you ever had a rusty nail? I said, no, I think, let me try that. So, man, you know, and those rusty nails, boy, they did me in really quick. And, you know, I'm throwing up on my boss, at the dinner table. And, you know, might not be the best way to get ahead, you know, in a job situation. So it's becoming harder for me to kind of keep it between the lines, you know, with my drinking and using. And I kind of survived the New York experience. I get back, transferred back to Ohio. And this again is, this would be 79, I guess. So my solution to kind of feeling like my life is getting a little out of control is to say, you know, the real problem here is this society that we live in, man. This society is bullshit. It is, this sucks. So I bought a van, you know, I quit working, had a little bit of money, bought a van, you know, it was a silver van. It had all the, you know, the psychedelic colors on it. I just started, driving, you know, and trying to find odd jobs, you know, to survive. And, you know, finding lots of people that were interested in getting high and, you know, and drinking. And also finding that my sense of who I was willing to hang out with was getting progressively lower. You know, I was hanging out with some pretty shady characters. You know, it was normal to be, guys with guns, guys that were definitely, you know, not the kind of people that if you had asked me a year ago, this wouldn't have been normal behavior for me. So, you know, I I'm surrounding myself with people that make it easy for me to say that I don't have a problem. Okay, I can see, you know, they might have a problem, but I don't have a problem. So, but you know, this kind of lifestyle kind of lasted for a while until I ran out of money, and then I said, okay, you know, I've had my little freedom. Let me go back and get a real job, and so I was able to find some kind of work, and again, you know, what's happening is I'm still not growing. I'm still using drugs and alcohol the way that I've always used them, and it's, you know, there's a progression to the disease. So I get transferred to Atlanta in this job, and this is where it begins to get really dark, you know, because I feel completely alone, and a lot of suicidal stuff started to come up for me. So, you know, that's one of the cool things about that now, as I look at it, is, you know, when people talk to me about being suicidal, I'm like, okay, yeah, so, you know, I mean, it's not like this terrible thing that you can't talk about, because I spent, you know, a number of years feeling that way, and you know, I can remember my coping skill at that point was carrying a knife along with me so that if I wanted to slit my wrist, you know, I could, and, you know, just really stupid things like that. And, you know, I kind of had a mental breakdown, and again, it had nothing to do with drugs and alcohol, but, you know, I checked myself, you know, into a mental institution. There was a place here in Smyrna called the Bronner Institute. Yeah, yeah. This was probably 81 or 82, something like that. I remember there had been an Atlanta Hawk, Eddie Williams, who had been at the Bronner Institute right before I thought, you know, that's pretty cool, you know. I'm kind of following in Atlanta Hawk footsteps here, you know. But anyway, I got there kind of with romantic ideas that, you know, okay, you know, I don't know what my thought was really, but, you know, I checked in voluntarily, and within about 10 minutes after I checked in, I realized that my key objective was going to be checking out. Okay? You know, and I was going to do whatever I needed to do to get out as quickly as I could. You know, and they didn't really see a whole lot of problems with me other than, oh, well, maybe you need to, when you go home, you know, throw away all your drugs, throw all your alcohol down the drain. And of course, I did that. Until, you know, the next day when I decided it was probably a good idea to refill. But anyway, that was a little warning sign. And, you know, I began going to AA meetings, you know, in 81 or 82. And I just, you know, I was like, this cannot be the solution. You got to be kidding me. Stopping abstinence is the, you guys... There, I knew there was people I could hang out with at meetings that had found a better answer. You know, well, I just needed to figure out a way to control my drinking and control my using. I didn't need to stop. I just needed to control it. So anyway, after this kind of mental breakdown, I did start working in a whole different line of work. I started doing computer programming. And that was a cool job for me. I could stay in my head and, you know, it was cool, and I could stay stoned pretty much all day and, you know, doing what I needed to do. And, you know, this is where I met my ex-wife, was, you know, in this time. And what she tells me, because I don't think I could really see myself at all clearly during those, is that anytime anyone would say anything about feelings, you know, I was like off, you know, I would go somewhere else, you know, and, you know, I was the guy that people would always worry about when we go out and party, because there's no telling where he's going to wind up or what he's going to wind up doing. And so my solution was, you know, I had this philosophy that I was very willing to articulate to anybody that would listen, that, you know, the way I was living my life is I'd rather burn out than fade away. You know, and that was, this, in my mind, it was this conscious choice. I had all this integrity, you know. This was who I was, man. You know, I want to burn out and not fade away, so I'll live the life that I want to live. And I had a further philosophy that life is, you know, one big shit sandwich, and the only difference is the size bite we take each day. You know, so these were very deep philosophical thoughts, you know, that, you know, I was living my life by. You know, and so anyway, things at this job began to get to unravel, and I went in to talk to my boss, and I said, listen, you know, I'm going to quit, and she says, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I want to move down to the coast, one of the coastal towns in either Georgia or North Carolina. And, you know, really, my whole objective was just simply I wanted to live. You know, by this time I had a DUI. The consequences had become more and more serious. So I just wanted to find a place that was on top of a bar that I could live, and then just kind of, you know, be at the beach and, you know, find some kind of work. And, you know, again, my life objectives became smaller and smaller. And my life became smaller and smaller. And so, you know, she really kind of got through to me and said, you know, you should go through treatment. And, you know, I did go through treatment at that time. This was in, 1984. You know, the turning point was a really simple turning point. I had made a really strong commitment to myself that I was going to go to a movie and not get high. That was the commitment I made, and I couldn't do it. And, you know, that's what put me over the edge. So it wasn't some real dramatic thing. It was that simple thing. And, you know, I went through an outpatient treatment at Charter Peachford, and, you know, I did what they asked me to do. They told me to go to a halfway house. I spent 6 months in a halfway house. They told me to go to a three-quarter way house. I almost spent the full time. I was supposed to spend a year there. I spent 9 months, and then the person who, you know, became my ex-wife, you know, she asked me to move in with her, and so that became part of my new solution. You know, so, you know, first part of my story is kind of that. The second part is, you know, I really stopped drinking and using July 1st, 1984. I don't talk about that because, you know, for the most part, after I left the three-quarter way house, I would occasionally go to an AA meeting, but, you know, I got this idea that abstinence, you know, that I couldn't drink and I couldn't use, but I didn't really get the program, okay? I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't work the steps, and, you know, I was on a dry drunk for a long period of time, okay? So, you know, those of you that know me a little bit know that the date that I use for sobriety is November 23rd, 1999, you know, and that is when I really, at that point, I was so full of anger, you know, and I was so full of hate, and I was so full of confusion that, you know, I had left, you know, at that point I have a wife and three kids. You know, living in Woodstock, you know, outwardly looks pretty okay. Inwardly, if you were to talk to my son, my youngest son who's here, you know, he's had to endure a lot of crap, you know, a lot of my stuff that I never dealt with when I was a little kid. All this emotional growth that's supposed to take place had never taken place. So, you know, if I'm supposed to be assembling a bicycle and the bike doesn't assemble the way it's supposed to, man, you know, no telling what's going to happen, okay? So these were the kind of things that were, and you know, I was asked to leave the house that day, November 23rd, 1999. It wasn't the first time, but this was, you know, that time. And at that point, you know, I was really unsure what I wanted to do. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to live or I wanted to die, you know. And so part of this story is really about whether you're drinking or you're not drinking, there's more to sobriety than abstinence, okay? And, you know, and I, you know, what happened to me is I went back to the NABA Club November 23rd, which is where I'd gotten sober originally, and you know, I got serious about this program, and I started going to what was called at that time, I think it's still called this, the Early Morning Study Group. And the Early Morning Study Group met at 7:30 in the morning. They'd have a meeting before the meeting that's typically started about 6:15, and my sponsor wanted me to be making coffee before that meeting, so I was getting there by 6 and making coffee, and you know, I had a sponsor, I worked the steps. This sponsor was a pretty no-nonsense kind of guy, and I got better, you know, and my life changed. And the spiritual dimension of my life became real, you know. There was, when I had gone through, you know, recovery, I did discover this power greater than myself that was keeping me sober, you know. But I just put it in a box and said, okay, well, that's the power I'll use to stay, you know, to stop drinking and using. But I didn't want to use it in any other parts of my life, okay, because I wanted to control everything else. What happened, you know, the second, you know, in 99 was, this was a power that if I had any chance of really using it, I had to be willing to follow some principles, and those principles are way beyond a compartment, you know. And so, you know, there's been a lot of struggle in the midst, you know, if I had to say where have I had more struggle in my life, hey, there's probably been more struggle in the sobriety portions of my life, you know. I went through a divorce, you know, and that was a very painful time. But, you know, I'll tell you, man, all those things have strengthened me, you know, spiritually. And, you know, I do see, you know, with a new pair of glasses that there is a joy, you know, that's available in life. And there's an adventure that's available in life. And there is a spiritual dimension here. There's a word, you know, the book, The 12 and 12, you know, in the foreword, you know, it's got a cool way of describing, you know, what sobriety is. You know, it describes it as, you know, the 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. You know, and this idea of becoming usefully whole is a very cool thing. You know, and a lot of it's, you know, learning that these wounds that I never really dealt with in my life, through the steps and through these principles, you know, I can begin to heal. And as I begin to heal, I begin to know what it means to be whole. And as I become more aware of what it means to become whole, I have something that I have to offer somebody else. You know, and so I see my wounds today as these great blessings. You know, these wounds are what brought me to AA. These wounds are what give me some kind of a connection to another human being. These wounds are what, when I get through some level of healing, convince me that there is a power greater than myself that can do for me what I can't do for myself. And they convince me that there are principles that if I'm willing to live by these principles, not only will my life change, my vision will change, what I see will change, what I experience will change. You know, what I have, you know, from a really meaningful point of view in my life, you know, today, you know, do I have fears and anxieties? Absolutely. You know, do I have many shortcomings? Absolutely. Do I have most of the time, you know, kind of a real zest for my life? Absolutely. You know, I'm full of excitement about my life. God has shown me so many things that allow me to be excited. There is a, you know, instead of the, you know, life is one big shit sandwich, the only difference is the size bite you take, you know, that philosophy, you know, what I really do believe today is that my life is a gift, you know, and that this gift is constantly being given, and that unfortunately most of the time I don't see it, you know, but there is this gift of life that I can experience, and that the things that my shortcomings, my imperfections, are not things to be avoided. In many cases, they're to be celebrated. You know, there's a really great book if you haven't read it, the guy that wrote the kind of the history of AA wrote a book called Not God, which was the history of AA. Then he wrote a book called The Spirituality of Imperfection. It's a really good book. And it's great for me because it reminds me that a lot of, again, my imperfections are what make this whole thing kind of go, and so I have a lot of gratitude today for the things that at one point in my life were the things I was running away from. These are the things that now as I embrace them, they're the very things that, allow me to experience this wholeness and this happiness that it talks about. And I've seen, one of the really bizarre things in later life is how simple my life has become in many ways and the meaning that these simple things have for me. So about 4 years ago, I started singing in a choir at this church that I go to. And, I'm supposed to be a bass. And I really suck, this is a humbling experience being in this. It's a good choir, and, I am constantly, not where I need to be. But, there is a beauty in harmony. And, harmony does not exist without diversity, And so, instead of spending so much time trying to be the same, if we can accept our differences and find a way to, be in harmony with each other. And I think that's what this program teaches me. I mean, what's the book say? Something like, we are people who would not ordinarily mix, I think is the phrase, something like that. But there is a harmony. There is a harmony that's real, in these rooms. And there's a harmony that's real in our lives if we learn to use these principles to make our own kind of whatever octave we're on, but if we listen to each other, then we can kind of, get ourselves in some kind of a balance with one another. And, the beautiful things often about harmonies are you don't really have to be great, as long as you're on the right pitch. There is a 1+1=3 reality to a harmony. And I can be off, but if someone else can pick me up, and when my light, is not, burning, if I can go to you and touch your light, that's what this program has taught me. And I think my concluding thoughts are that the importance of vision, the importance of not limiting our vision, and that the power greater than ourselves that I've experienced wants our visions to be bigger and broader. And there is, I believe, a promise of finding the extraordinary in the ordinary. And there can be this adventure to life that not only makes it life worth living, but it makes it worth sharing. So I am very grateful for this program and grateful to be here. Thank you.